It is my great pleasure to introduce Sebastian Barry, whose work is extraordinary, as I'm sure you already know, but if you don't, you will find out tonight at the reading, but who's also an inspiring talker and thinker.
Only at night, though, not in the morning.
That's right. Afraid I got the best of him last night at dinner, but the remnants, I'm pretty sure, are still going to be fantastic. So please lend your ears, your attention, your intelligence to Mr. Barry for the next little while. You're in very, very good hands.
And I'll be depending on you to ask questions. Depending on you completely. I wish I knew who you were. I know Saatchi a little bit. Because I do, having been writing for 27 years, I do believe still, at the age of 50, absolutely, in our undertaking, whatever it is. Writing is an attempt to identify or to eke out the significance in a great sea of insignificance. For instance, this morning when I was preparing to come to you, having a shower and all the rest of it, my wife has this pair of very lime green shoes, and they were on the floor, and I passed them, and when I passed back the other way, she looked at them and she said, "What's that?" And there was a spot of very, very red blood on these lime green shoes, and we suddenly thought, somebody in this room is bleeding. From where, and should we stop it? And we looked everywhere, as you do, which bit of me is, and it was on the back of my hand, strangely enough. And I hadn't noticed any wound there. And so I think I'll be always haunted by the spot of red blood on the lime green shoes in Montreal and what it might mean. I wish I knew who you were, but at the same time, when I was... what they call Writer Fellow at Trinity College in Dublin. I don't know if you know Trinity College. I had 7 students on me in a creative writing class. I was easily the worst creative writing teacher that had ever been. It was about 11 years ago, and if somebody was good in the class, I couldn't quite overcome the instinct to poison their soup or get rid of them. Because, after all, they were going to take the bread out of my children's mouths if I let them go on any further. There was one man there who confidently, and with the proper arrogance of a young writer, I think, and I hope you all are hopelessly arrogant and self-believing, said that, oh, he wasn't interested in writing, he was going to be a banker in London. So I thought, well, I'm going to waste the next 6 months on you, but you've said it, so now I have to endure that. He only came back to my mind because a couple of years after this writing class, maybe 4 or 5 years, long enough for me to forget most of the details of it, I suddenly got a book in the post, which was called The 25th Hour, and it was in proof. And it was by a writer you may have heard of called David Benioff. And it said, the publisher's letter said, that Mr. Benioff was in your class and he wonders, would you give a blurb for his new book? And I thought, who the hell is David Benioff? Is he in my class? 2 weeks later, I think Spike Lee bought the rights to this book. Incredibly annoying. Made a huge film of it. Then this mysterious person wrote the screenplay for Troy, and he's now the hottest young writer in Hollywood. There's probably 53 of them, but to this day, I actually don't remember him at all. I have a strange feeling he was that arrogant young man who said he was going to London to be a banker. And if it was him, do you know, it's a lie I sort of appreciate, because I remember very, very well, despite my great age, you know, being 22 or so and lying to everybody about what I did, living in Greece and saying, you know, I I work in the jewelry shop, or anything but say you're a writer. Whereas all around you, there were people saying, oh, I'm a writer. What do you do? I'm a writer. And so the person that's lying about it, maybe, the person to think about, I don't know. Anyway, when you are that age, you're given all these four. I was reading Latin and English at Trinity. So the thing you realize when you're reading Latin is that, you know, there is nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new to contribute story-wise. Even Plautus, the great comic Roman playwright, apart from the fact that television hadn't been invented, was writing essentially beautiful kitchen sink comedies for television. You know, you see that everything's been done, which was very useful. But you're handed these ideas of forms, right? You know, you can write plays, you can write novels, you can write poems. And after a number of years, you ask yourself, why do those things exist? Why are there these things, that these boxes or receptacles into which you can pour your whole reason for being alive, the whole purpose of your life, the whole confusion and sadness and joy of your life? Why have people chosen these things? And you wonder exactly what they are. Do you know, you're looking for the first time at these receptacles and wondering why they were invented. What human purpose do they have? And I can only assume that what we do predates Homo sapiens sapiens, Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, that some previous species of ourselves was crudely, but maybe not, maybe most finely, singing in some other manifestation of humanity, and that we have inherited, therefore, these mysterious forms from even before our own species. Theater must be very ancient. It must be very ancient, deeply, deeply ancient. That doesn't mean that it isn't new, just because it's very old, strangely enough. So if that is so, then when one of you come to write a poem, you're finding in yourself that answering echo of a very ancient process. So that form, in fact, is nothing to do with academia or nothing to do with knowingness, but is an innate, instinctive form that somehow finds its shape from the shape of your own mind. And so therefore your duty, in a way, your only duty is to pay heed to that form. And in a way, not give it a name. You know the way Plato said, the thing itself, it is disappears as soon as you name it. The first thing, the Greeks say, the protopramata, is in there. As soon as you start to talk about it and name it, it disappears. And our strange job is, I mean, I'm assuming perhaps wrongly that you're all creative writing students, but anyway, you're all reading books, which is in a way the same thing to me. Well, more importantly, our job is to not think about, in a way, what we're doing. I mean, in a way, writing is the least posh thing you can do. You know, it's not like chemistry or physics. It's not grand. It's deeply, deeply instinctive. Not knowing, for me, is much more important than knowing. So I'm just ruining your lives, anything I say here. You must forget everything I say, as you probably will anyway. I am struck, the more I go on, by the absolute mysteriousness of it, to the degree where I think maybe it's almost, you know, as I say, better, at some level, not to think about it. To be released into your work, think of the amount of things that have to be granted to you before you can do that. You have to forget everything you know. You have to forget all the books you've read. You have to, in a way, to forget who you are, so that in order that who you are may become impersonal and represented in this other form that is then able to be, the register of that is able to be found by strangers to you. Despite what our modern culture makes us think, you know, a book is not successful to the degree where it wins prizes, obviously, or it is the degree to which the depth charge of the book can be felt and sounded by the individual sitting in secret. I mean, the reading is so secret, so quiet. It is such a pure activity. It's much less provisional than writing itself. The reading of a book, which almost becomes, in some people's hands, the writing of the book. That to me is the measure. And that is the thing we must be true to. And that is the thing we cannot betray. I mean, this is, it's the paradox between the individual persons that you are, you know, with all your faults and all your graces, and the impersonal nature of what you're doing. You're sending ancient forms of yourself and not yourself out into the world. And what distinguishes those things is that very, very curious and impenetrable thing called voice. Voice is the, you know, the second most important thing you have. Do any of you, for instance, I mean, in ordinary terms, sing? Are any of you singers? Do any of you think that there's a relationship between how you sing and how you write? Because after all, that's what we call voice in writing. Sometimes I have made the mistake of singing. Tonight and at the reading, I have to sing a little bit from the book because there's a song, Roses of Picardy. There's a wonderful Irish playwright called Tom Murphy, and who wrote the Gili concert. I'm not sure if you'd be aware of him, but he's the contemporary of Brian Friel. And he is a wonderful playwright, very difficult playwright, and he doesn't travel very easily. And years ago, in 1983, I was in Annamacarrick, which is one of our writer retreat places in Ireland. It was Tyrone Guthrie's house, in fact, the man who founded the Stratford Ontario Festival. And I was singing, and Tom said, you know, you should give up this writing lark and go out on the road and, you know, be a singer. Because he wrote a famous play called The Gili Concert, which was about a man who wanted to sing like Gili. So all Tom really respects is singing. And that was kind of upsetting, you know, when a senior playwright says to a young fella, I can give up the old plays and go singing, you know. Is that a comment on his opinion of your plays so far, or what the hell is it? But in later years, I realized that that's exactly what I've been doing, which is what voice is in writing. Voice is a sort of signature. There's a horrible tradition, no, I shouldn't say horrible, there's a tradition in British writing of serviceable prose. Do you know that if you notice the prose, there's something wrong with it? Now, I don't know, that's, as an Irish person, that's a very mysterious idea, that you should write in such a way that somehow the signature or the voice is invisible. And maybe it's correct, but at the same time, if you think of any poet or writer that you love, in that odd way we love writers who may be long dead and mouldering in their graves, there's something about the signature of their voices, something inalienable, sort of recognizable, and it's the thing, it's like your favorite bird, you know, the favorite bird song. And then there's those birds you don't like to hear, those crackly, screechy birds. But then there's those lovely birds in the morning when you're lying in bed and you hear this bird, and somehow your life is explained a little bit by it and you feel at ease. And there's something very easeful about that. That doesn't mean it shouldn't upset you like Rilke or something, but it's the thing I hope you all have somehow, you know? But how to define it and what is it? Again, maybe better not to, but I'll try anyway. The least, when you look at somebody like Hemingway, who seems to be following almost that British thing, serviceable prose, and yet paradoxically, it's the most. It tastes, everything Hemingway writes tastes of Hemingway, smells of Hemingway, and it's, you can't get away from the fact that even the more simply he's writing, the more Hemingway he is, to the point of parody. And that's another thing about good writers is their voices are so distinctive that they fall over into self-parody inescapably. They're often accused of this, but I don't see how they could possibly escape it. Because in the tiredness of the world, you might be very capable of imitating your own voice. instead of, I mean, this is a great sin in writing, but great sins are unavoidable in writing. I hope you will endure your disasters as well as your successes have to be endured. I don't mind talking about that in a few minutes, because it's after about, in recent times, in after 99, I didn't go anywhere for a while. You know, I didn't do anything like this. I stayed at home for a couple of years, and then I was halfway through this book, or I thought I was halfway through this book, but actually I was only at the beginning of it. But I went to Toronto, and you know, the Writers' Festival there, and A.S. Byatt was there, and Ali Smith, and various people like that. And it suddenly struck me, as if for the first time, as if seeing them for the first time, as if I wasn't a writer myself, as if I was an ex-writer or a retired writer, it suddenly struck me how incredible they were, how much they were veterans of their own lives. It was like a room full of people who'd all been to Vietnam, and they'd been in the woods for years, you know, recovering from this terrible experience, and yet there they were, sort of functioning, writing, and even A.S. Byatt, you know, talks like that, and it's all very English, but still, she too, behind everything were these veteran writers. And I just sort of pledged my allegiance to them all over again, as if I had never seen them before, because they were the living version of the dead ones, you know, that we all admire. And I went home, and I think with that understanding that we don't have to be prospering all the time, wrote afresh or renewed or differently, or as if beginning again, which is also a wonderfully important thing to do. Let me just glance at this impenetrable little piece of paper. Oh yes, well actually I have reached that. Fame. Hands up, any of you who are longing for fame. Honestly, since I'm being honest, be honest. You put your hand up. Yeah. Is that your hand up? Yeah. So you're great. You're actually putting your hands up like this, which is a very, very restrained way of putting your hand up. But I assume you've all put your hand up. And rightly so. Arrogance, ambition, ruthlessness, evil intent, just on the verge of violence, excruciating hatred of one's fellow writers, all very healthy and useful in the gaining of this fame. And it will prey on your minds to a degree you don't even suspect. My lovely friend Max Stafford Clark, who's directed some of my plays, who's in his 60s, says there is never any morning quite as delightful as the morning you open the newspaper and see one of your closest friends being murdered off by the Guardian or the Telegraph. This is all horribly true, and we have to admit to it. I mean, I've been working for 27 years, and most of the time it's been quiet. The first 7 years of my working life, I probably made about £200 a year, and if I was lucky. So naturally, since I was a man, I had a girlfriend who was working, which is shameful in itself. Even towards the end of that 7 years, we were heating the house in Dublin, our flat in Dublin, with Alison's grandmother's fuel vouchers. I don't know if you know what fuel vouchers are. But, you know, Dublin winters aren't like these winters, but they're pretty cold, so you must heat the house. So we had these fuel vouchers belonging to my, you know, they're social assistance fuel vouchers given to the old, to warm the old. And these belonged to Ali's grandmother, who had been dead for 2 years. So that's how we were getting along. And then for some reason unknown to myself, I wrote a play called Boscardi's Boys, and which in Dublin was a hit, and then which allowed us to pay the rent. And when I say pay the rent, it meant that the days of Alison and me actually going under the bed when the rent lady came by had passed for the moment. I mean, the reason we used to get under the bed is because the rent lady was so nice. You know, she'd come so gently that it wasn't that she was cruel or anything, it was just we didn't have the money to give it to her. And that's how we lived. And also, you have to remember that in Ireland, we don't have creative writing schools. You're quite on your own, and when you're a writer in Ireland, you've got to invent the wheel each time. You don't know how to do it, you don't know what to expect, and you're just battling on, really. There were indications that we weren't completely wasting our time, but at the same time, there was no money. And I had avoided the theatre for a number of years. So, having paid the rent from the theatre, that tends to keep you in that so-called form. So I was in the theatre then for the next 10 years and wrote a number of plays, and they were all fairly all right, received. But then, very mysteriously, about 10 years later, we were opening a play in the Royal Court in Dublin. Do you know this theatre? The Royal Court Theatre, which is a new writing theatre. And it was a 60-seater theatre, which is tiny, obviously. By chance, we had a very great Irish actor in the play called Donald McCann. And I was thinking if we could get out of London without me having completely humiliated Donald, that would be a good thing. This was a play called The Steward of Christendom, which is a play about an old man who absolutely does nothing in the play. In fact, all that happens in the play is he's in a county home, he's just a poor man, and he's getting a new suit from the person who's looking after him. That's all that happens in the play, nothing else. And I thought this play would play for 4 weeks, and if we could fill a 60-seater theatre, that would be fine. And this is really a story about not knowing and so-called success. The radio station came in before we opened during preview, and the morning we opened, the radio program came out, and it was this mad rave review of the play. And in the afternoon, there was the Evening Standard, which is the important evening paper there, and that was the same. So before we opened, this had happened, and suddenly, from having no booking, we were booked out for the run, and it went into the main house at the end of the year. It traveled all over the world, went to Wellington, came to Brooklyn Academy of Music in 97, and was a tremendous success. And it's probably the least happy time of my whole life, because you're not able to be easy with yourself. You can't be just working. You can't just be drifting. You can't just be idle. And it gives you that dreadful thing, something to lose. Because you know, even as that cycle has risen up in front of you, and briefly in Newsweek you're the greatest thing since fried bread, you know it has to go all the way back down again. And you can feel it in your bones that has to happen. And that is fantastically difficult for the provisional, sensitive, unclosed off people that you have to be to write. And sure enough, a few years later, I put on another play called Hinterland in Ireland, which we opened in England to rave reviews, and we thought, oh, thank God, you know, we'd be all right. Came to Dublin, and I don't think any play in the last 50 years has been so excoriated and reviled. So the whole country, from the moment of being raised up as the great thing, the next few years later, you are the worst thing that ever happened on earth. And your brain has to assimilate these two strange extremes. And maybe the truth is that it's nothing to do with you. It is, you know, it's the book of life, or it's the thing you have to endure. And it is true what they say about the impostors of success and failure. I have never really met such unhappy people as really successful people in the moment of their success. But it tempers them. And somehow or other, if they're lucky, a few years later, a sort of veteran quality that I was describing in Toronto comes upon them. And then they become, I think, truly admirable, not for just for their work, but for their survival. What I'm saying is that if any of you are, you know, in this beautiful time when you're starting, the actual, it is in some ways like that moment when the soldier goes to war for love of their country. And that's how, you know, young people get sent out to war. They're full of belief. And maybe it's not the same as soon as you think about what war does to people, but this writing life is spectacularly difficult and demanding. I don't know what it's like in Canada. I mean, if you think of America, where, you know, success can be described in some terms as a sort of virus. If you think of any number of wonderful young writers who have had these wonderful books and then have been burned, you know, to cinders. And some have to come through that like phoenixes out the other side. It is like a story. If you read any biography of any writer, it is like a heroic story. Even Malcolm Lowry, who took the trouble to drink himself to death, even inside of that, there's a sort of true heroism, I think. I hope I'm putting you off. Doing my best. It all comes back, though, to that question of being true. Yeats talked about the perfection of the life or of the work, which I think is a false separation. I think there is something about how you deal with the world and what that does to your work. Tennessee Williams, when he became, you know, drug addicted and indifferent to other people and lonely in hotel rooms, mysteriously became a lesser playwright. I mean, that's very simple and rather bleak, but I don't think it's impossible to live, you know, even though you're hopelessly failing at it, trying to live what they call a good life and working well, you know, that there is a connection. And maybe in this strange century, that isn't the worst thing you could undertake. I was one of those people at the turn of the century that thought, I have two boys and a girl. I thought this is the century of peace. Maybe it was something Clinton said that I misunderstood, but I really did think we were going to have this incredible century. And now here we have already our Boer War and the very edge of the First World War for our century. So what to do about that? I mean, they say this year is best year for fiction, for a Commonwealth, Irish, English, and that's all your country too, isn't it? Fiction for 25 years. People say, is it because of 9/11? Is it because of, you know, Mr. Bush's use of syntax, or what the hell is it? I don't know, but there is a sort of gearing up. I mean, there is a sort of gearing up. There's a sort of instinctive response to what we're being presented with. You were very reticent about ambition. Could you put hands up who thinks Clinton was a good president? I agree. And who thinks George Bush is a good president? See? Therefore, who's going to be the good man? You know, who's going to be the good woman? Yeah, and it may be that the most consistent figures that are incapable of being elected falsely, you know, are artists. That puts a sort of a gargantuan responsibility on your backs. So you have to be impossible. One impossible thing, you have to be true to try and lead, to try and have a good life, which is impossible, but anyway, you're trying and failing. The other thing is to write well and be true to what you are and your own signature and your own bird song. To find your work by not being able to find it, by being in the dark and being completely confused and stumbling through the brambles of your work, and being willing to work for 10 years and in absolute misery and confusion, and then suddenly finding this other place of success which actually makes you twice as miserable and confused. And why do you do that? I mean, the truth of the matter is, Pache, the whole American reward system, you don't do it for yourself. You're actually singing because you can sing. You're actually singing because there's somebody lying in a bed somewhere whose life is briefly explained or resolved by your singing. So if it costs you everything, then it is worth it. You know, and that is the beautiful game we're at. You know, and that's why I wish I knew you. Because I sort of salute you in a strange sort of way without knowing you. Because you're embarked on something so unlikely and so dangerous. And the last noble thing that's left. And I'm so hoping you're going to ask questions now. I can say no more.
I'll start.
Oh, I don't want the teacher starting. I want to come. No, please do, yes.
Well, I'm just curious just to pick up on what you just said and maybe to relate it to your present author a long, long way, and about to singing for somebody who's lying there in bed, and what you were saying to me this morning about soldiers, and maybe you could just simply talk a little bit about the genesis of that relationship in the novel, the soldiers, the Irish soldiers in the First World War, and your feelings of responsibility towards them, perhaps as an artist, or just your emotional bond.
Well, of course. I mean, I don't know what I was thinking really when I started this book, but the position of Irish soldiers in the First World War is curious because of the war, because of the 1916 rising, the War of Independence in Ireland, and the Civil War. These men who in 1914, when essentially Ireland was British, who went out in British uniform to fight in Flanders for whatever they were fighting for, maybe for home rule, which is one of the things many were looking for, or even for king and country, because that's the country they were born in. These men became, quite soon after the war, in general terms, considered to be traitors. And their story was suppressed. Therefore, if you were a mother, and in those days they used to send the uniforms back, so if you were a mother in a house in Roscommon or somewhere and this parcel arrived with your son's uniform, and which may or may not have been cleaned, and there's a hole in the uniform somewhere, and you think, is that the hole that killed him, you know? And you're sitting there in your lonely house in Roscommon, and maybe you put your finger in the hole of the flannel and you think, wow. And then you can't say it to anybody. And then there's there's tens of thousands of those people. And then there's the men who came back terribly injured, because in that war, because you were facing into these fusillades and the rest of it, you might take off your face or take off your arm or take off something very important. And so you could spend the rest of your life in some awful home. I mean, imagine being a young person, that happens to you. You don't have to imagine it. There's many Vietnam soldiers. I'm sure there's many younger soldiers now who've been in Iraq. You come back completely maimed and spend the rest of their lives hidden away. And it wasn't just them hidden away. Even people who came back whole and reasonably sane rarely spoke about this thing that they had done. And what I wanted to do, I think, was... since some of my great uncles were in the war, was if we were going to talk about them, and if we were going to say traitors or heroes or just fellas going out to war, then at least, and specifically was for Irish people, I suppose, at least Irish people would know what they were talking about. So I tried to make it my business to be as clear as possible about the battles that they were in. So that was, and what they went through, and the gas and all the rest of it. So, you see, unlike Canada, where I suppose ambiguous and horrible though the war was, I presume that you are allowed, if you wish, commemorate or remember your grandfathers or your great-grandfathers. And it was often said that the Canadian soldiers that went and the New Zealand soldiers that went do you know that they were able to, even in the Commonwealth or even in that empire, were able to fight for Canada, for these places. Whereas we were not allowed that mysterious and ambiguous retrospective grace. And of course, you know, if you're Scottish, you could remember your people, Welsh. Or, and it doesn't mean you had to admire the war, you know, but you could remember the fellas, the kids that went out. So that was this closed over story for about 80 years. So much so that in our Irish history books at school, the First World War would be maybe half a line in relation to the 1916 Rising. That was the First World War. And yet 200,000 Irishmen went out to fight in the war, and 36,000 were killed. So if you go to your football stadium or wherever you go of a weekend, and you look around you, and the man says, tonight we have 36,000 in attendance. And you look around at all those faces, and that's how many died of the Irish. Well, I mean, as I said, I don't know what I was thinking when I started the book, but when it was finished, and even though judging your own work, I thought it was an absolutely appallingly bad book. And I was telling Kate, being in Germany, in Dusseldorf, and the book was in proof, and I was lying in bed because I had to read from it the next day, and I was reading it. And I just never read such a dreadful, dreadful book. And I was wondering, how did I spend 2 years on this, actually on proof, and it reached this awesomely bad state? And it was those dark nights of the soul when you're just absolutely ashamed to have perpetrated this fictional misery on the history of literature. But even so, even having had those extreme feelings, by some miracle then, when the book came out, that wasn't the point of view that was entirely agreed with. And so having got through that hurdle, so never think you know anything about your work, so is the lesson of that really. Never think you know, you write something this morning and you think, oh, it's rubbish, you know, but at least I wrote it, right? You don't need to think that. I mean, in that play, The Steward of Christendom, the last story of the play, and I'm very clearly writing it and looking at it and thinking, that was a bit easy, that's probably not very good, I'll probably find something else for that bit of the play, that's okay, but I'll do that later and yeah, be okay, it doesn't matter, okay, and nobody will ever have to see how awful that is. And in fact, I never changed a word of that thing, and it became, you know, the thing that everyone, you know, there's always something people talk about in the work, and that was always the thing they talked about. So maybe that sets up a horrible possibility that as long as you think it's awful, it's all right. But this could be treacherous. This could be really get you into trouble. Anyway, where the hell was I? Why was I saying that? The soldiers. So even at 50, my brain nearly works. That's good. No, it's hopeful. When I finished the book and it was received fairly well and people were talking about soldiers and their grandfathers and their great-grandfathers, I realized in a way that the book wasn't mine, that the authors of the book were these men. And by some mysterious chance, at that time, in 2003 when I wrote it, it was that time when the last man of even the people who had survived died. Now, of course, there were many women, but in those days, not combat. They were nurses and the rest Irish women, but I'm talking about the men who fought. They had all died. So an old silence, to an old silence was added, a new sort of silence. And it was as if in that moment some Egypt living in South Wicklow had been conscripted in by these men to make their story, because that's how it was being received, and I was very grateful for that. So authorship transferred from me to these men, and therefore it seemed to me that I was responsible for them in that way. And
Just talking about that responsibility when you're writing a historical novel, you list quite a few books that you used during your research. Can you talk a little bit about the process of researching for a historical novel and how that worked? Like, did you talk to people or was it more book-based?
Yes, I think in the first place, I don't really believe in historical novels. I think that everything is happening. Everything, all of it, is happening all at the same time. I think novels are not as enslaved to our sense of time as we think. Because it is a form of time travel in the sense that you can go back to the place and you're actually saying this is the place and this is the thing and this is it happening. And that it's not about the past, you know, it's bringing something maybe from the past but making it present. You see, reading books is very difficult for me. I don't read a huge amount of books. Isn't that disgraceful? I actually couldn't read till I was 9. I could say that it was because we were in London and I couldn't learn to read in London or something. It was only when I came back to Ireland and in our classroom they had this thing called the catechism. I don't know what religions you are, but this is a Catholic thing. And it starts, who made the world? God made the world. That's the beginning of this big book. So if you're a child who can't read, you can fit in that sound God with that word God. And you're trying to hide the fact that you can't read, of course. So I learned to read from all this religious stuff. And that's how I finally did learn to read. But it's still quite difficult for me. And to actually read all those history books, which I felt I had to do because I knew I was going to have battles. You can't, well, I suppose you could. And there was a time when I would have, but you can't absolutely make up the First World War. I mean, you could, but... And in a previous book of mine called The Whereabouts of Ennis McNulty, I certainly made up bits of the Second World War. And people did actually note that. This couldn't possibly have happened. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But I thought I'd better do this one. The most useful book are some beautiful history books because it's such an unmentioned subject. Naturally, the people attracted to it are rather maverick historians. And they write rather beautifully about it. But at the same time, the most useful books were the very dry regimental histories, which are written by the line officers at the time. And then they're extrapolated, and then you get this incredible detail about what would happen in battle, which you then read like a form of mathematics, forgetting all the while, as they often did themselves, the staff officers, that all these battles had failed at every instance, and you know, hundreds of men had been killed at each moment of these accounts. And that's what they leave out, the absolute obliteration of companies and Italians. But still, at least you knew their path. But as a writer, or as a friend to the people in the book, I felt that at a certain point, maybe after Toronto, that my Toronto moment, is that I was allowed into the trenches with them. So that reading became sort of redundant, thank God, again. And whenever they were going to do something, I had to follow them up the ladders, you know, and they'd go across the no man's land or whatever, and I would try to keep behind them so that I could see what they were seeing and hear what they were saying. And that's a wonderful feeling as a writer. I mean, once every 10 years, maybe. It's like being a reporter. And that was incredibly exciting. I was so excited in my room doing this that I used to be, you know, stupidly fearful that I'd be shot, I'd come up the ladder and be killed. I wouldn't be able to get across with them. You know, it is as fiendishly simple and ridiculous as that. So I had to read them because I had to sort of know, but in the end you follow your people, don't you? You follow them. And in this sense, especially in a war book, they're leading you by friendship. That's as close as I would ever get to a group of men, and by accident, rebuilding our house in South Wicklow, and this has something to do with life and work, I spent 2 years with a builder. And if you ever read the book, you'll see that the sergeant of the book is called Christy Moore, and he actually was my builder, my Dublin builder, working on my old house in Wicklow. And we were side by side for 2 years, and at the end of the week I was boss, you know. Ah, thanks boss. You know, I'd give him his money. But during the week I was his slave, and I was digging and trenching out, and because I didn't do anything meaningful, I was 3 months digging out the ground floor for this man. And this was Christy Warren, you know, it was like, thanks for fucking Don Leary. And I mean, he became a sort of magic man to me, because all the other men had come in, like Joe Clancy, the electrician, and we'd sometimes the house would be full of men. You know, building is so hard and so awful that they're like soldiers. They're talking to each other in this very special way. And if you're trenching or something and your back is so sore and you're so demoralized by this work, and you're on the edge of tears, and somebody goes by and makes a quip, you know, sort of a joke, even a sort of criticism in a light sort of way, it lifts you out, you know? This is very soldierly. So that was my real research for the book, without me knowing I was doing that. I mean, Christy was a totally magic man. Christy drank a bottle of whiskey every night, and I would collect him about 5 a.m. to bring him down to the house. And he'd always be sober. Now, how can you be sober at 5 a.m. after drinking a bottle of whiskey? And Christy was maybe 56 or so, and quite frail, but an absolutely wonderful builder. He was the Lowry of the building trade. He was a poet in his own way. And we'd look at old beams upstairs in the house, and you know, they've been pretty messed around over the years and kind of not looking great. Were they going to collapse? When you have 3 children, you just don't want the upper floor collapsing on the lower floor. And we look at these beams, and we've had engineers in to say, oh, you have to do this and do that, and it's going to cost so much, and we didn't have any money. And I'd say to Christy, what do you think of those beams, Christy? What do you think? Do you think we have to do what they say we have to do? And he'd say, oh, jeez, boss, no. Those beams aren't going anywhere. Not in my lifetime. Not in my lifetime, you know, and that's great, and you feel really relieved, and then the next day you'd be thinking, his lifetime. that could be next week. Rest in peace. So I rest my faith in Christy Moore. He's in that book anyway, if you ever get a chance. Research. What can you do? Think how difficult this was for me. So just ask me a question. If you think you feel you can't ask a question, think what I felt when I came in here and saw you all. I could barely speak. My throat dried. Panic rose in every inch of me.
You write theatre and novels, which I do well, both have different approaches to storytelling. Do you find the writing two very different types? Do they complement each other or conflict each other, or there's no relation between writing them?
I think there's a huge relation. I think it's, what I say I've been doing for the last 20 years or so is looking for these people in my family who have been forgotten or suppressed for whatever reason, political reasons or religious reasons, and trying to invent their lives for them. Sometimes it seems to me that certain people want to have plays around them, and certain other people want novels around. Some only want to hide in poems, and that's enough. I know this is a curious way to think about it, but for instance, with that book I mentioned, the Whereabouts of Ennis McNulty, I did write a play for that character, who was a great uncle of mine. It was called Freedom for Nigeria, and it was about him and his Nigerian friend Harcourt, if you ever read the book, and they're in the Isle of Dogs, and they're old, and they had this awful doss house for sailors, and it was about that. But Ennius, as a character, was completely non-introspective. You know, he did not have the sort of inner life that I need a person to have if I'm going to write a play about them. Because I don't really write plays. I write these great, galumping, awfully difficult, dreadfully unwise, long speech thing. I mean, there's more play, drama, etc. in this novel than in any play I've ever written. So it's because I'm looking for the expression of the person through their own grasp of syntax and their own, you know, that I think their lives, that our lives hide in our syntax, that our whole way of speaking contains us. So even after death, you can sort of make somebody reappear by trying to find their way of speaking as fully as you can, and then the actual person is manifested by that. So I had to write the Whereabouts of Ennius McNulty in order to do him, because it was a third person narrative and it was the only way I could reach him. So I don't make any distinction. I noticed on the Booker shortlisting thing, you know, the little bit of press that comes out after it, that some people said, well, why is this man on the shortlist? Because he's a playwright. Do you know? As if to say that if you write plays, or if you've had a good time writing plays or something, it's impossible that you would write novels. And I don't understand quite why people say that. They do not like you to cross over. They, the literature police, who are everywhere. They don't want you doing that, you know. But in fact, all my plays and my novels do come out of the poems I write. I mean, when I was a young fellow, the really thing I wanted to be was the greatest poet that ever lived. And I wanted to be, you know, greater than Heaney, greater than Yeats. That was my ambition. That's the success I wanted. In fact, my signature as a poet is so faint and tiny that it doesn't register, you know, almost at all. But it's the essential thing for me to do in order to reach these other places. So it's a riddle in a way, isn't it? I don't know why that is. Do you cross over forms? Do you move easily between? Apparently it hasn't been done very much, plays and novels, and still you start to think about it. I remember an article in the New York Times saying no Irish writer has done this since Beckett or something, but I don't think that's true at all. And then there's Michael Frayn, isn't there, and these people in England, so. Maybe that's just all journalism anyway, doesn't mean anything.
Would you say that over the years you have developed one person that you said you like the analogy of singing for some of the bands? Is there one person that you're singing for in bed, or is every work that you do for a different person?
Okay. Well, whoever that person is, or persons.
But is there one that emerges over time that's consistent, or is it different each time?
No, I just have a sort of vague idea. I don't really know who those faces are. I don't think it's helpful to know. Do you mean a particular person I'm writing for?
Or a type of person, or something. Could you define that person? Describe it? Or is it different? Sounds like it's different.
I think the basic answer to that is, again, it's a bit dubious, but I mean, the answer is dubious. The question is wonderful. The answer is, you know, somebody who feels as passionate about it as you did. I mean, you shouldn't take joy from when people telling you they wept over your book, but you do. You feel delighted. It's awful, isn't it? I wept. I was on the bus. I thought, oh, that's great. No higher praise. Or laughter, you know. John McGarren, do you know John McGarren? I'm sure you do. He's an Irish writer, but he's in his 70s now. He wrote Amongst Women and That They May Face the Rising Sun. I think it was called By the Lake over here, I'm not quite sure. Anyway, John was launching his memoirs. His new book is out, and it's a big cause. You know, it's very welcomed. And I said that to him, which Satchi said to me. I said, John, you know, I cried my way through the book, even at the amusing parts, but I was still crying. And he was quite cross about that. So I hope you're laughing as well. No, but I wasn't really. And then he read a rather amusing bit from the book, which is totally uncharacteristic, which was the funny, you know, the funny bit in the book at the reading. So I say I don't mind then, tears or laughter. But that's the person, isn't it? That you see, when we talk to each other, I mean, this is totally unnatural, me talking to you like this. Further, not only do you have to try and keep awake at 10 o'clock, but, you know, I have to force my brain to talk. It doesn't want to do this. Whereas the opposite, I mean, I'm privileged to do it, and I'm delighted to make the effort for you, but when you've written the book and it goes to the reader, it's so at ease. Everything is their choice. They can stop reading, or they can leave it alone, or they can get up, or they can, you know, go and kill somebody and come back and finish the book. You know, it's a completely different world, and I never thought about, you know this thing, some people have this thing about immortality, and, you know, your children basically are your immortality. But it is a rather interesting thought that if by chance your work somehow had that quality or whatever, it could slip through the centuries, and that person in that bed would be so remote to you. that you couldn't possibly understand. They wouldn't even that the English you were writing in, the Irish English you were writing in, would in fact be considered a sort of lost classical language that no one spoke anymore. So, you know, that you'd be a sort of Chaucer to them or something. But that heart to heart, that, you know, Cavafy writes about that all the time. You know, it's that feeling that you could still signal somehow. You know, like Voyager, you know, still be sending that signal back. You know, sort of mothership or something. It does seem entirely magical. I think it's better not to know who that is or if that could happen. It doesn't matter, it really does, one way or another. But the reader, I don't know. The reader is sacred to me. Surely as inventive as writing. Surely as dancing. Which raises the odd thing about fitness when you're writing, you know? It really is an athletic sport, writing. To be so well when you're doing it. That's hard to arrange. You know, tennis players, when they're playing at the top of their game, they're so fit, they're so able, and at the same time, they're so relaxed. And it's that idea. I mean, I'm straining to find what it is, but that being so relaxed, that when you reach somebody reading in so relaxed a way, that you're communing across that line of relaxation in some way. The ease of the mind, the peace of the mind. I mean, that is the thing that's precious to me, the private mind. That has nothing to do with the public world, does it? It is that private mind where you are unassailable, where what you are is beyond criticism. Do you know? I mean, I have a little poem about my son when he was born. And I describe him at the end as a poem beyond comment or opinion. Do you know that feeling that you're not being... it's hard to say what that is. Anyway. I didn't answer your question.
At the beginning you talked about sort of the mysteriousness of everything, like where you sort of have to let go and forget everything you know.
Yeah.
And I guess like in my own writing, I have that sometimes maybe for, sometimes a line or four pages or something like that, and then it's like I come up against what, the time to think. I feel like here I get blocked, like it's like a wave that I can't surf on through a whole story.
Well,
yeah. In your process of writing, do you try and find a way and go all the way through, or how much time do you spend like structuring a novel? Set, like,
I do know what you mean.
Yeah.
I'm afraid none at all. That is a terrible admission. Don't tell anyone. This came home to me very clearly when I very foolishly in 1998. Because I had bought this house, actually. It's funny, good things come out of those decisions and that. But in order, because I thought I was going to have to find an awful lot of money very quickly, I was asked by Dodgers and Dimmy in New York to produce a book for a musical for Hans Christian Andersen. A new book. Do you remember the film with Danny Kaye? Thumbelina, Thumbelina. Yes, those songs. They said, why? They asked me, I don't know. But anyway, Martha Clark came over, she's a choreographer, and she came over and said, I've been asked to do this musical because Julie Taymor has had a huge success with The Lion King. So naturally, the New York way is that if you've had a success with one idea, try and reproduce it, she said. So now they've asked another mad choreographer to do a musical. That's me, she said. So would you like to write the book? So I said, wrongly, yes. So for the next 2 years, I was flying over to New York and Connecticut every 6 weeks. This is like a parody of success. And at they don't pay you anything for musicals until they pay you lots. That's to say when it opens and it's successful. But until that point, all they're doing is they're flying you first class. And when you get to the airport, to Kennedy Airport, there's a stretch limo waiting for you on your own, a stretch limo. And if you have to go to Connecticut in a stretch limo, you realize why in the films there's always three ladies in the middle of a stretch limo. And it's not for the reasons we think, it's actually for ballast, to keep that bloody thing from doing this and blowing through the back of the limo like, oh. So, you know, I did my best, but I realized, you see, that that book of that musical was not in any way inside me. And that no effort to not know and be stupid or at ease or relaxed was going to produce the book of this musical. So I wrote, for the first time in my life, I wrote something. And it's just that thing you're saying, well, you actually know what you're, you sort of feel yourself writing. As if you're your own reader. It was a disgusting feeling. And I did it for 2 years because you're faithful to your original saying yes. And Martha made huge efforts, and Dodgers and Timian spent $2 million just developing this thing. And if she was going to do it all flying, why? You know, on the ropes. And she was a choreographer, but nobody actually did any dancing. We cast people who couldn't sing. I wonder why we did all those things. I remember we were living in the west of Ireland at the time, and I remember going over to New York for a day on the airplane and to see the man who was going to be cast as Hans Christian Andersen. So go over to see him, to say yes, and then come back the same day. There's nothing more lethal to your body. So, trying to drive home and falling asleep in the car, you know. So there was a lot of this actually for the whole thing, and nearly killing myself. And that seemed to me to be punishment for doing that, for saying yes to something that you couldn't possibly ever write. And that was a horrible feeling for 2 years, to have undertaken something that you had no access to, that other people have access to. You know, it was wrong to do that. So you can imagine. Well, maybe it's a discipline, you learn it. Maybe it is a sort of Eastern ability. The best thing to do is keep telling yourself how stupid you are. Do you know how unable you are, how kind of low you are, so useless. So that when you get to when you get to that thing, you're not expecting anything of it. And somehow, from your absolute abasement, it honors you, you know, like there's a God in the computer or something that's trying to comfort you in your misery, and then something happens, you know. The difficulty is, if you do that and make something instinctive, you know what all the good things are, and everyone notices, and then everyone does things, and you get some idea about yourself, and you have to cast it all off again. How do you get rid of success, the idea of success gives you of yourself? You know, that slightly strutty sort of thing, you know? Or when your wonderful teachers praise you, you know, for a day or two you're crippled. You know, how could you possibly do anything? It's difficult. But maybe it's not, you know, when I talk about things, the things I do, it mightn't be right for everyone. You talk about structure. I believe that structure is, as I was saying with form, it's accessible as a sort of form within your mind. But there's an answering space of the book in your mind, that it's ancient. We call them novels and plays and poems, you know, but there's, that's what we call them, but the first thing, the Platonic first thing is something else. So that's what you have to reach and be true. And it's incredibly difficult, as you say, to stay there for any length of time. And if you haven't stayed there for any length of time, go away from the desk, you know what I mean, from the table. Only be there when that's happening. And that's the discipline of not working, which is terrifying. When I was writing that book, The Whereabouts of Ennius Macnulty, the whole family went down to Cork, to this lovely house, so I could write this book. And as soon as I got there, the book didn't want to be written. You know, I had about 5 chapters, and it just simply didn't want. I had to wait another 4 months till we got back to Ireland in the depths of winter before this whistle tune started again and I could go again. But you see, I'm respecting that. I'm not going to work through that. There's a lot of people who say you have to work through that thing, and I don't really believe that anymore. But it makes it very difficult for what do you do for those 4 months? I mean, what do you do? You shouldn't be left idle, you know, as a human being. It's not good for you.
Is it at moments like that that the other genres come forward for you? Has that ever happened specifically, maybe even with poetry, for example? Because I know you were mentioning at dinner last night that your process with poetry is very different. Poets sort of arise.
Well, most poets, real poets, feel they have to produce a book about every 3 years. I mean, even Heaney does that, 3 or 4 years. I think there's a sense that if you don't do that, you disappear. And one of the most profoundly disturbing things for a writer who has been visible for a while is disappearing. Then you have to disappear again and go away and be nothing. But because I, you know, this Yeatsian ambition disappeared, all I want to do is write poems that came naturally, you know, literally like birdsong. So I published a tiny book this year, but it was of 16 years of poems. There were only 14 poems that I wanted to keep. So you could say it's a good thing I was trying to earn my living from poetry. It would be a very difficult thing. But they're the ones I kept, and they're the ones I wanted, and it was a privilege to be able to publish that. You know? If you're a poet and you're starting off, you have to have, you know, at least 48 pages, because that's how the books are, 48, 56, 64, however it goes. It's a tyranny. But nobody wants to publish, you know, 20 pages of somebody's poetry. They'll ask you to double up your book, or, you know, so that your own self feeling of what's right can be quite interfered with in that way. But I there can be huge silences there, you can imagine. You know, poetry is not something you can fall back on because it's not going to be there for most of the year. Sometimes I work on something because I'm trying to avoid working on something else. I largely wrote The Whereabouts of Venice and Magnolia so I wouldn't have to write The Steward of Christendom. Do you know that feeling? Where you have something you think is rather difficult to do, so you do something else you think is a little less difficult. So you're playing one thing off against the other. So that's a sort of dance. But do any of you remember when you're writing? I mean, if you produce a work, do you really remember the time when you did it? Isn't there a mysterious sense that the time spent making that story or poem is something, some other thing than the time you spend living your life? You know, to really think back at yourself there, it's not you in a way, it's another you, you know, different you, kind of an essential you, you know, the best of you. You know, the thing that is your excuse, that when they come to execute you, you can say, yes, yes, I did all those things, but actually, there were moments in my life when I was this other you. And they will say, well, then, you know, we forgive you. That's the hope, anyway. One of my books is being, so you won't know these people, but James Nesbitt is one of the sort of big television actor in Britain, and he wants to do The Whereabouts of Venice Magnolia, so for television. So I said, well, that's great, you know, but I couldn't possibly write that. So somebody's written a 3-part series, and that's fantastic.
Why couldn't you do it? Just time-wise?
No, I just couldn't imagine doing it. I just couldn't. That musical moment, I can't really. I don't think I should try and do this, even though, you know, it would be a wise thing to do in other ways, you think. But anyway, with this book, when I only had 2 copies in the world, my daughter Carl is 12. Odd things with this book. Actually, first time in my life, maybe because Carl was old enough, I used to go up every evening and tell her what had happened to Willie that day. And, you know, that was for a year. So the whole year that she was 11 and 12, she was hearing the book. And I wouldn't read the book, but I'd go up and tell her. So when I got to the end, and I was very shocked by the ending myself, I had no idea what was going to happen, and it took me by surprise. And I was very upset. And I went up to her, and you know, you don't want to be upset in your daughter's bedroom, you know, you don't want to impose something on her. But I just told her as detachedly as I could what had happened to Willie. And she burst into tears. You know, and she was my first reader without reading the book. You see what I mean? I just told her the book. And then I was crying. We were sitting on the bed crying. So I thought, when I got the first two volumes, the first two hardbacks of the American edition, that I should give her one of these. So it's now in her room sitting there. She still hasn't read it. It's that edition, in fact. And the other person, so I had this book, and it was in that Germany time, and I actually met in the airport a man called Noel Pearson. Do you know Noel Pearson, who produced My Left Foot? Do you remember that film? And I had worked with him some years before at the Abbey Theatre, and I just looked at him and I thought, I like that man, do you know? He's a curmudgeonly, foul-mouthed Dubliner, do you know? But actually, I like that man. I think I'll send him the book. So I went home and put the book in an envelope and sent it to him. I don't know why. In fact, the last few times I'd met him, he'd given out to me for a casting so-and-so, and I could have had Richard Harris, you know, this sort of bend-in-your-ear thing producers do. So I hadn't enjoyed that. But anyway, I sent him the book, and it was Sunday morning. It was Sunday. Following Sunday, four or five days later, and he rang up the house, which astonished me. And he just left a message on the phone. And you know, I remember I'm 50 years old, so you shouldn't be getting excited, maybe. But he said, "This is Noel Pearson. I'm in Berlin, and I've just finished your book, and it's fucking wonderful." And that was the message. So I put down the phone. Noel Pearson has rung the house. How amazing. So I went in to the sitting room. My wife brought me to the middle of the sitting room because there had been an occasion some years before when I got so excited about something that I jumped in a doorway and hit the lintel and knocked myself out. So she carefully brings me into the middle of rooms now if anything like that happens. So I'm jumping around like an idiot. Oh, God, it's wonderful. Because I really think you should try and enjoy the primal things, don't you? And then I met Noel, and he said, "Well, we'll try and make a film out of it." And he got me to write a few scenes from it. And I was so attached to the men, not even thinking it's a book, that I thought I'd try and write the screenplay for them. And that's what I'm trying to do. I don't know how to do it, so if you have any help, if you have any helpful hints. I've written a first draft that's so long, that Noel said, "This is a cost of £100 million. Few curses thrown in there. If it's like this, it has to be 110 pages. You don't know nothing about screenwriting." So, yeah.
Have you done it? You've never done it before?
I have done it. I mean, a couple of times, you know, and felt the wind of inability blowing around my ankles. But, yeah. I suppose maybe it's not everybody, but I suppose I am an entirely instinctive writer, so. I'm always amazed when things go well, and I'm always distressed when they go badly, but the fact is, no matter how critical people have been of some of the stuff I've done, or praising of it, but especially when they're critical and they say, this is awful or whatever, I always think, well, you should have seen the first draft. You know, if you think that's bad, this is as good as I could get it. You know, so what would they have done if they'd seen that first draft? They'd have killed me. So it's now 200 pages long. So don't quite know how to make it 110 pages.
Can you talk a little bit about your editing process?
Yes, and I adore it, I have to say. I have an absolutely lovely editor, Faber, called Angus Cargill. He's just a young fella, you know, and they do. They send you the two or three pages of stuff, you know, which I do love, and I don't think you're supposed to love it, you know. But I'm just amazed anyone has read it so closely that they can do that. And I will send them virtually the first draft. I mean, I will. This book was 400 pages long, in sort of draft, you know, that draft, and. Now it's about 270 pages, so at some point I must have gone in and just whipped out lots of stuff. It's funny when you're whipping it all out and you think, that's not very much, it's not going to be, but somehow it's a lot, you take it out. And that is, I don't know what the equivalent of that is in building terms, but it's sort of laying out the room up to the point where you're going to put the plaster finish in or something. You know, you're going to, it's there, but it's not quite habitable. The book is not habitable. So then somebody will send you these notes, and you'll think about them, and some of them you will use. And then there was a curious time with this book where scenes kept occurring to me, whole little scenes of things, when the book was gone to the printer, as far as I knew. So I would send Angus another page and a half, and even right up to the way beyond the point. I noticed the American edition actually is not really a finished edition, because some of these didn't make it into the American. And to the point where he stopped emailing me back, and I thought, he's just embarrassed now, and he's not. But I kept sending them all over Christmas, little lines here, and then I'd find out what horse won the Grand National that day, and I'd put it in somewhere. Madness, in other words. And I opened the book then when it came in the finished copy, and this wonderful young man had actually made sure that everything had gone into the book. So he was having the same experience with the book that I was, which was a sort of mad love affair. Editing from a crass editor, let's say, who could be wonderful in other ways, but has, you know, over the years has been very painful, where people want certain things that they shouldn't want. Certain American editors have a penchant for wanting. I like your book. We're going to get 100 pages out of this. You know, it's like something they say. It must be on their charter of things to say to authors. You know, if your book was 80 pages long, lovely book. I want 100 pages out of this. You know, how do you do it? But that's been a bit painful sometimes. But I'm a bit afraid to read over stuff at a certain point. Are you like that? Is anyone else like that? I am so in fear of it. And when it comes in proof, I'm afraid to read it. Because of that Germany, that night in Germany, because I know how I feel about it, I just don't want to face that trauma in a way. So I don't quite read it, you know, when I'm correcting a song. Try and do it sentence by sentence, so it doesn't seem quite so awful. That's bad, you know, I should be braver than that. I'm very relieved when an editor says, you know, you need to get a lot out of the front of this book. But I must say, after page 150, yeah, it just sails along. So you sort of think, you're never going to look at those pages again. They sail along, so why would you look at them? But it is painful for me to read in readings, to read it and think, I really should have gone back in on this. And done it. But what is the price of going back in? And the other mystery is, All books, all paintings, all pieces of music are riddled with imperfections. But, you know, when you look up close, but when you stand there, it looks like a picture. And if you made the imperfections perfect, it would no longer look like a picture from the place you're meant to be viewing it. So there is an argument also for the grotesqueries in the work. I don't think in the poem. In a lyric poem, couldn't stand that sort of thing. There's something about a book. I'm not making an argument for imperfection, but no matter what you do to a damn book, it still is coming back at you with things that need doing. So what the cutoff point is, I'm not quite sure. Or even why that is. I mean, people read your book and they may say and think it's the most wonderful thing, and all you can see is the grotesque repetitions. Do you know? You become hypersensitive to it. And I think that's the point when you should stop, maybe. That's what it is. Sort of neurosis of editing. I'm saying all these things, and I'd love to know what the way you work is, because then I could steal your methods and put it to use in South Wicklow. Well, my grandmother, this thing called a gentleman's agreement in Ireland. You know, you don't actually have a contract. And my grandmother used to say, if you want a gentleman's agreement, first find your gentleman. And I say, if you want a master class, first find your master. So I think this should be, for today, should have been retitled, you know, the idiot class or something. Because that's the way, that's the position the writer really occupies. The rest is myth. the myth of the American, there's real America, there's the myth of the writer, and then there's the real writer.
I think we've seen the real writer, and
whatever it is.
We thank you very, very much, and we look forward very much also to hearing the news tonight.
Okay.
It'll be a treat for all of you who haven't read the book.
I shall do my best.
Thank you.